What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Serious Angler Podcast, powered by our friends over X2 Power Batteries. We are back with another show, and unfortunately, we are captainless. Andy is under the weather, not feeling too hot, so you guys are stuck with me riding solo tonight. But nonetheless, we have a banger show, and one that I'm really excited about, because, these shows, it's been the rave of conversation for, I don't even want to put a number on it, but a long time of just, you know, futuristic things, what's been the rave. And I am just excited to talk with a guy that I've learned a lot about, I've heard a lot about, and I finally get to actually chat with him tonight because he's probably got the best handlebar in all of fishing. We're talking some flipping tonight. We're going to talk some Florida swing with Bassmaster Elite Series Pro Brad Watley, who I've heard from several people throughout the industry, stand-up dude. So I'm really looking forward to tonight and diving in, because seeing what's behind him, I think him and I will get along very, very well when it comes to the outdoors, things like that. But before we get him on, and we do have a part two for tonight. I know in some recent weeks we haven't had one lined up. It's just been a hectic couple weeks of work, as well as a bunch of things going on here at the podcast network. We're grinding away, trying to do our best for you guys, as well as set some things up for some big moves this year. But we do have a part two tonight. We have Kayak Fishing Weekly host on our network, Justin Largen, joining, as well as Drew Gregory, who's about to have their first Kayak Adventure Series tournament on May 3rd, which is going to be, I can't remember, at least to my recollection, a tournament that has been, remember the specific river name. We'll have Drew talk about it when we get on, but it's all going to be shoal bass, which is going to be pretty cool to tune into and things like that. So I'm looking forward to that. And I know our pal Alex Rudd's going to be fishing it. So there's going to be some cool content coming from there of people throwing glides and things like that for some big shoal bass. But before we get them on, they're going to be part two for the show. We're going to do some little bit of a fish it, box it, or trash it. So you guys have been a fan of that. So we're bringing that back this week. But before we get into the show, a couple things for you guys, especially if you're Omnia members, but if you're on Omnia in general, they're running a couple pretty sick deals, and everything that we talk about tonight, with Brad, as well as the fellas later, we'll link down below. That way you guys can go and grab the different baits, things like that. But Omnia is doing a buy two, get one free soft baits right now, as well as 15% off jerk baits, which is a pretty wicked deal for right now. Unfortunately, the only asterisk on that is it does not apply to Megabass. So sorry for folks that are thinking you're going to not pay $25 for Megabass jerk baits. They're still $25, but you can use our code nonetheless and try to save you guys a few bucks. But those are linked down below, as well as for my Northern folk. We just had our first local tournament here in New York this past weekend. So if you're getting out in the spring, things are warming up, you know, the whole country is now pretty much bass fishing. And you're looking for some new shades, Hobie Eyewear. We have our 20% off code. They've been doing a pretty bad job, honestly, of reminding you guys that year long we have this code, 20% off any pair of shades you guys want. The link is down below. All you got to do is click our link, and the code is automatically applied to your entire order. So feel free to snag some, especially when they're only $80 and they're as good as they are. I know for me, the Sightmaster Plus has been pretty clutch for this spring, especially going down to Murray, going to Lake Norman. That was pretty clutch for me. So check those out. And we had a couple things we're going to talk about with Andy, because Andy actually did go fishing today. So the sucker's playing hooky for the podcast tonight, but he went fishing today. I don't know if that works out, but we're going to give him some crap nonetheless. But I'm looking forward to today's episode here. And so I think without further ado, let's get him on here. Mr. Brad Watley, what's going on, sir?
Not much, man. Just hanging out. Ready to do a show with you.
When did you get back from St. John's? It probably was today or yesterday?
Last night. Yeah, I got back last night. I wound up staying at the Airbnb just because, I mean, dead gum, dude, that was back-to-back weeks and fished, I don't know how many days that was total with practice and the tournaments, but it was enough of them that I wasn't fixing to make that drive overnight.
Yeah. And well, especially because, you know, working the classic, and then you have Fork, and it's been a bender for a lot of you guys for a while. Like if very little, if any, you know, days at home, I can imagine.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, I mean, that's kind of, that's this life. You're, you know, as though, I mean, your balls to the wall whenever you're going. And then, you know, and then when it slows down, of course, you know, I like to pick that bow up and the ball, you know, on a few of them whitetail, but, or elk or whatever. I actually went on an elk hunt this past year. And I mean, I know we're here to talk about fishing, but if you've never been on an elk hunt, that was my first time and they were bugling. And I was literally like 8 yards from a, you know, like a 375, 380 class bull. And I mean, he was screaming his head off. And I'm telling you, every hair on my body was standing up. And I had done ran like a mile across this mountain trying to get to him. And anyway, cows got downwind of me and winded me. And of course, they took off. But I've never had an adrenaline rush like that. I mean, I've caught a lot of big fish in my life, and you get an adrenaline rush from that. But, and you know, I've always said if you could bottle that and sell it, it'd be the most expensive drug, you know, in the world, catching a giant. But that elk, when that elk's screaming that head off, man, I don't know. That's a different level right there. For guys that have done it all their lives, I mean, I know they're used to it. I had never done it, always wanted to. But, yeah, anyway, it was fun.
That's a whole different, that's like for people that may not understand that feeling. It's basically take the split second when you're like punching a mat or you're flipping, which we're going to talk about today. Right, and you get that bite and you first set the hook, take that and times it by a million. And that's what's going through it. Like it's for turkey hunters. It's like turkey hunting times a million, like kind of just that when you get a turkey up close and it's, you know, gobbling, doing whatever. And it can kind of reverberate through you a little bit. It's louder than you expect. It's you take that and just multiply it. It's
well, you know what's crazy? I was actually talking to Hackney and Weigh In Line. We got through weighing in on day four. I've never killed a turkey. And I mean, people look and they're like, that redneck's never killed a turkey. I mean, and of course I said that to Hackney, he's like, well, hell no, you're always bass fishing. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I guess that's what the deal is. But good buddy of mine, Brock Mosley, we're supposed to, if we can get it lined up, we were going to do it last year. We've got a couple of break or a couple of weeks here on a break. Of course, he's got cows, so he's got to get his cow situation because he's been gone lined up. But we're going to try to head up to the lease in Oklahoma and try to get a bird because I've never done it. I mean, I know people that are huge turkey hunters, and it's like, I mean, it's like an addiction to them that's unbelievable. I hear them talk about it. They're like, dude, don't ever go kill one, because if you ever kill one, I mean, if you, you know, you call one up and you kill it, it's like you're hooked for life. But I've never done it. I want to do it. We're going to try to get it done this week.
Yeah, it's the biggest problem, at least for me here in New York, is for people that know, April is the dumbest time of year to fish in New York. Like if you have a hook on the end of your line, you're going to catch the crap out of them. You're going to catch big ones because they're fat. They're happy because ice is gone and they're feeding up to get ready to do their thing. And so, but also, driving through all these fields in the morning, I'm seeing them strutting everywhere. And I'm sitting there like, I'm trying to go fish, but I'm also seeing them in fields. And so it's the worst thing for me. And like my brother is to hunting that I am to fishing. And so it's easier for him to go and get out in the woods. But it's such inner turmoil when I'm driving to the lake and I see him strutting like that. It's like, God, the amount of videos I sent to my brother, who's now in Utah, which, him and I, years and years ago, when we were in high school, went out to Montana and hiked and everything. And that's when we first heard elk bugling like up close and everything like that. And I think that's why he moved out to Utah now and hunts them and lives out there.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, he moved out there. He went full bore, like, I'm going to live this now. And so I'm going to go visit him when it's season there and go scout with him type of deal. But yeah, dude, it's there's a lot of guys like yourself. You know, Matt Airy, Mosley, there's a whole handful of guys, you know, Hackney, that give up the rod for a little bit to either go bow hunt, turkey hunt, whatever it is. And it's, that just screams outdoorsman to me. And I think that's where comes. Like, you kind of see that. It's almost like a weird trend of guys that, like yourself, that like to get up shallow, like to get instinctual about things. Like you see that with Hackney and Airy seems to catch them every freaking where you guys go. So it's kind of like a trend with that. The guys that are a little bit more like, I'm going to go look around, I'm going to see the birds, I'm going to be in nature and catch them that way, where it's kind of like that trend. I don't know.
Well, and it's a generational thing too, really. I mean, in my opinion, you know, I mean, it's like, if you look at the guys that are, you know, mid-30s to 40 years old, or even older, you know, guys in their 50s or whatever that are fishing professionally, you know, they didn't have, for the most part, they didn't have, there was no internet, you know, there was nothing pushing bass fishing, you know what I mean? So it was just, you were either born loving it or you weren't, you know, I mean, that's just part of that. You're born with that. I mean, and that, you know, that's, I guess that's why, you know, when you're talking about instinctual, I mean, that's what those guys came up, that's how they came up fishing, you know, so it just comes natural to them. And that's just all outdoors. I mean, that's the hunting side. That's whatever. I don't personally know a guy that's, you know, at least in their 30s that is professional bass fisherman that don't hunt as well. I mean, in fact, most of them, I mean, I know most of them had rather hunt probably than they had bass fish. You know, I mean, it's, I've never personally met Andy Morgan, but I mean, you know, I've watched a lot of stuff on him, and I mean, you know, he's made the comment several times. He just bass fishes to, you know, to feed his hunting habit. So, yeah, I mean, it's just that, I think that's that, you know, part of that deal. Those guys just grew up, you know, loving bass fish, you know, that age group. And there wasn't, like I said, there wasn't all the, you know, all the hype like there is nowadays, you know, obviously. I mean, we live in different times, obviously. I mean, things, you just didn't have the flow of information. And when I say a flow of information, I'm talking about, you know, all you had back then was magazines, you know, for the most part, that was it. And now we've got live, you know, I mean, we've got podcasts. So it's just different, you know, that's basically, you know, in my opinion on it.
Yeah. And it's funny because we got Andy, the co-host here in the comments, but he is not on the show here to derail hunting conversation. So I always get on tangents when we talk hunting. So we're here. He's not here to disrupt the conversation. So we can keep going down this. But my last point on it that I loved seeing is guys like, you know, you see with Andy Morgan, especially because I think it's First Light. That's his title now. And then you have like Atkins and Wiggins. I know there's more that, you know, work with like a bone collector, and you see some guys that are working like Millennium Tree Stands. Like I love seeing that crossover of guys that are like, I also have this hunting passion. I have this following from fishing, and a lot of guys that fish also hunt. So it's kind of cool to see that mesh over from the business side too, to see that passion come in. But
they're just outdoors. Do you have any hunting sponsors? What's that?
Do you have any hunting sponsors?
No, no, not hunting sponsors. Everything hunting wise is coming out the back pocket.
Well, here you go. Anyone that's tuning in, he's a free agent.
Oh yeah, free agent for sure. We got some big deer, and we go all over. So I mean, it's we could definitely get some good content on some big animals we put on the ground.
Heck yeah, dude. Well, I could talk hunting for literally hours, but one thing I really wanted to break down with you is, one, talk about your Florida swing, and then two, like when it comes to flipping vegetation, whether we're talking, you know, pencil reeds, submerged vegetation, mats, things like that, it can, when you see when you go to a Florida lake, like you were on, and around the whole ring of it is all reeds that you can flip. It's kind of very overwhelming for even a guy that's been there countless times. So we're going to get into that. But one thing we like to do here is, anyone that's new to the show, is throw it back to the original time. Like, who is at fault for this lifelong addiction of fishing? How'd you get that started?
So, you know, my story is probably a little different than some other people. Man, I live in I grew up. Let me say this. I went to school in a town with a population of like 5,500. And I actually live 10 miles from there with a population of like 300. So, you know, fishing in general, I grew up fishing. My dad was a huge fisherman, but not a bass fisherman. He actually didn't even like bass fishermen, to be honest with you. We grew up using a mechanical mechanism called a yo-yo, which people probably don't know what that is, but it's just basically a spring-loaded little piece of metal with rope in it, and you put a hook on it and tie it on whatever you want. So we tied it on cypress trees, but whatever you want to tie it on. And anyway, that's what I grew up doing. Now, when I say I grew up doing that with my dad on the lake, I grew up on a lake called Caddo Lake, but I bass fished. I probably had like 8 or 10 ponds around, you know, within a couple of miles of my house. And that's what I did every day, every single day. I bass fished. When I got out of school, I went bass fishing. And in reality, I mean, I'm not trying to date myself. I mean, I'm 43 years old, but, you didn't have the big tackle store. I used to make my own spinner baits. I remember doing that when I was a kid. I make my own spinner baits. And you know, like a Meps rooster tail, I mean, you could buy that, and that was huge. I mean, that was caught a lot of fish on that. But that's all I did, man, was just walk the banks of ponds continually. I was addicted to it, and I can't really say anybody got me into it. My dad, like I said, was a big fisherman, but not a bass fisherman. So I don't know, really where that addiction came from, but no different probably than anybody else. Once you get, you know, and of course, like, what a tiny torpedo is, you know, I mean, we used to throw like little tiny torpedoes. So like you have a fish blow up on a tiny torpedo, I mean, you're hooked, you know? So, I mean, that's kind of my first memories of it. You know, I got hooked on it from doing that, from just, you know, beating the banks on ponds all the time, every single day. And, I think I actually stained one of the ponds. I don't believe there was anything left in it after a couple of years. And I remember now we used to eat them. I mean, there was no such thing as catch and release. And I mean, so I remember like I was 5 years old and I'd bring like one bass a day home or whatever. And my dad got tired of cleaning one fish every day. And, he told me at 5 years old, he was like, son, you fish and learn how to clean this fish. Cause I ain't cleaning them no more. And so I like, you know, learned how to clean fish. And, but dude, that's where it started for me. Really, there was, you know, like I said, my dad was an outdoorsman for sure. He got me into hunting, you know, got me into fishing. But it wasn't like that was out of the norm where I live. That's what everybody did. You know what I mean? I mean, everybody was hunting, everybody was fishing. And I was actually 19 years old. I remember I bought my first bass boat. I don't even think the company's in business anymore, but it was called an Astro. And it was a 17-foot bass boat and had a 115 Mariner on it. And, dude, I thought I was, I mean, I was like a Ferrari to me or something, you know. I mean, I'd come up in a stick-steer boat with my dad, a little 60-horse, 50-horse. And so anyway, bought that and just started, started fishing a lake called Caddo Lake, you know. And, but I had never had any lake experience bass fishing until I was 19. It was all ponds. Now, I was at a lake, like I said, every day, but it was running trot lines, running limb lines, running yo-yos. I mean, we was catching catfish and crappie, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I know, I mean, I'll just keep rambling if you don't shut me up and ask me another question. But that's how I came up, you know, just like I said, addicted to the bite. And that's what gets everybody addicted. I told the guy when I caught this past Saturday when I had the big bag on St. John's, you know, I mean, I caught a big one, put it in a boat, and of course I'm panting, you know. I mean, it's a big fish, and that dude's high-fiving me, you know, going crazy. That guy was a local from Jacksonville, and I said, dude, I'm gonna tell you something, you know. I said, it don't matter how young or how old you are. I mean, if you're 80 years old and you get that bite, dude, literally, if there was a way to bottle that, you know, and sell that 3 seconds that pandemonium goes on. I mean, it's, I don't know, dude. I wish you could just take a shot of that every morning, you know, before you take off.
I believe they call that now 5-hour energy.
Yeah, 5-hour.
At least as close as you can get to it anyway.
Right, right.
But so before we get into talking, you know, vegetation and Florida swing, yeah. So Caddo Lake, actually, me being the kayak angler, and we have a kayak show on our network as well called Kayak Fishing Weekly. There's a lot of people that tune into it that have fished Caddo, because Caddo is actually a pretty popular kayak tournament lake anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I have a vendetta against Caddo, but we won't get into that, or at least right now on this one.
She can be bougie, I promise you.
Yeah, I learned that quick. What if you could name one bait, favorite bait, or a way to approach fishing cypress trees?
Fishing cypress trees?
Yeah.
One bait and one bait alone. Um, if I'm going for a big one, man, it's probably going to be a jig. I'm probably going to throw a jig. And I'm talking that January, February time of year, because that's our pre-spawn, around here. Yeah. So, that can be a downfall, always fishing for big ones, obviously. But that's what I like to do. It's generally a hero zero kind of thing, and a jig is too. That's what a jig does. A jig will get you big bites, and a jig will get you no bites. But that's it. If I had one bait, you said just give me one bait and one bait alone to throw at a cypress tree, I'm going to probably pick that jig up.
Heck yeah. Well, we have a guy here on Facebook, Jeremy Johnson, that says, I used to donate money to Brad every time I fished a cat attorney. Well, it sounds like you had her pretty dialed, I'd imagine, growing up on it. But
It was fun, for sure. It's a different lake. It's the only natural lake in the state. It's half in Louisiana and Texas, but it's the only natural lake that's in the state of Texas. It's a beautiful lake. I mean, there's nothing like it in the country. I mean, I would say just about all over the country and looked at, lakes that have cypress trees in them and stuff, but it's nothing like, there's nothing like this place really. I mean, when I say it's dominated, which you obviously know. I mean, when I say it's dominated by cypress trees, I mean, the whole thing is cypress trees. Oh, yeah.
So. It's a sea of it. It's pretty overwhelming for this New Yorker that's used to light line and smallmouth. I go down there and I'm like, what am I looking at here?
Yeah, but it all looks the same. A lot of lakes that have cypress trees, they'll have a big open, like Santee and all that stuff. They'll have big open areas. And then, of course, the cypress trees, outline the bank. But that's not Caddo at all. It's you start on this bank. If you were able to go straight across the lake to the other bank, you're going to have to weave and dodge, 3 million cypress trees to get there. So.
it was pretty entertaining while we were there. We were there for the Hobie BOS Tournament of Champions, and they sent all 50 of us out the opening day of duck season. That's when I really learned what a real duck season is like. There was a lot of arguments and people dodging, getting shot at.
you got some freaking rednecks down there. I mean, I'm talking about crazy people. I don't know. Y'all might maybe want to pick a different date on that next time.
We saw that, and it didn't ring a bell for me, but some of my buddies that are pretty avid duck hunters as well that were fishing tournament were like, hey, have you factored in the whole duck season into your tournament strategy? I'm not getting shot at anyone.
Exactly. They'll shoot you. I promise you.
There was a few guys that had stories after that event that got into some heated things with some guys that apparently had like their duck blinds or whatever on some of the shell bars there, and it was like, he's trying to fish that, they're trying to shoot him, they just had to come back later whenever they decided to pick up and leave. But
that's the best thing, because that rod and reel don't ever they don't compete with that shotgun. So
You ain't gonna do it, especially in a plastic boat. I mean, your odds are against you.
They're stacked against you. Let them guys get their limited ducks, and then you can go fishing. But I learned that years and years ago. I'm not gonna say I've been shot, but I have been, let's say, peppered. I've had some shots rain around me in years past, and I love to duck hunt. So, you definitely kind of got to give those guys that water.
Yeah, no kidding. I learned that real fast. Let's get into your Florida swing. I think the biggest thing for you guys as professionals living a career of bass fishing is you hear it a lot from a bunch of guys who are like, just make it out of Florida alive. And I'd say you did a damn good job of that. So kind of walk us through like a brief overview of how Harris Chain went for you, as well as St. John's River.
Yeah, so my back was against the wall, first off. I had a good day one, a decent day one at Toledo, and a decent, pretty decent day one at Fort, at both of those events. But I crapped the bed on day two at both of them. And I don't even remember where I finished. You don't look when you finish that low. I mean, it was in the 80s or 90s, but it was terrible. And, so my back was kind of against the wall, but I knew going into Florida, And I really can't explain it. Like, people ask me, I've been asked a thousand times, like, man, why do you catch them in Florida? And you got to understand, dude, I had never been to Florida until I started doing this. So it's not like I have any history in Florida. I haven't spent any time there fishing before I started doing this for a living. But for some reason, I just connect well with Florida. Obviously it's loaded with, I mean, their golf course has probably got 15, 10 pounders in it at every golf course pond. You know, I mean, it's got giants in Florida, and I do well with big fish. In a finicky type of way. I mean, like, you know, if you're in there in Florida and in February, me personally, I mean, you know, obviously people catch them a million different ways, but me personally, it's, you know, I'm going to flip. That's what I'm going to do. 99.9%. I would love to catch them on a moving bait. Don't get me wrong. And I did this time. I caught them on a moving bait, but we were later in the year. But in February, I'm going to flip. That's what I'm going to do. I mean, I'm used to it. I understand it. I'm looking for 7 or 8 bites a day. That's my game plan when I go out. But we started out in Harris Chain, and you know, I really thought I was going to have a good shad spawn go down there, and same thing at St. John's. But day one was canceled due to weather, and of course that wind just never checked up. And for me, it just trashed my shad spawn, you know, areas that I had. There was 2 and 3 footers coming in on it. And I just couldn't get bit on it. I tried and tried and tried and tried and tried to get bit. But I had, going into that in practice, I had I fished a Pocka there in 22, I think. That's the last time the Elites were there. I did decent. Made, I don't remember, finished, I think, 30th or something, 29th, 35th, somewhere in there. I was in around the 30s. And I fished a Pocka the whole time. But the word wasn't out on a Pocka back then, you know, like it has been the last couple of years. And so it didn't draw as many people. And then this time I did spend a day and a half in a Pocka, and I really anticipated, I thought I was going to be in the first flight is why I did that. Because I knew they had a locking problem down there, where the lock was taking anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour, and you can, it only holds 3 boats. So, I mean, you just do the math on that real quick. Let's say your boat 25 and 17 boats go. Dude, you ain't going. You know what I mean? I mean, you ain't getting through. I mean, if you are, what are you going to do? Get through the lock, make one flip, turn around, and get back in the lock? You know, and the bad thing is you're dedicated once you go that far, too. You know, unless you better have something in Buclair or Dora or wherever, Carlton, one of those lakes, you know, to bail out on. So. But I had a phenomenal dude. I mean, I've obviously flipped my whole life, and I would say that was a top 5 flipping bite that I've ever been on in my life at Apaca. It was incredible. And but the weather, you know, and I don't know because I'm not a local there. All I can do is just guess. I drew a bad boat number, and so I was boat like 51 or something like that, which is horrible because that means on day 2 you're boat 53 or 54, so you're mid-pack both dates. So I mean, like, it was out. Like, I wasn't going to Pocka, and I was like, God almighty, dude, what am I going to do? Like, I mean, I'm foaming at the mouth to go down there and pick that Castaway flipping stick up. And anyway, it things work out for a reason sometimes, you know. I wound up obviously not going to Apaca, and I just stayed in Harris. I stayed in Big Harris day one, and I caught an 8-pounder, or not an 8-pounder. I think they were both right, like 7-14, something like that. But I caught one right at 8 pounds, and it was 8:30, and I was like, okay. Because I had my mind made up. You know, I was so far back in points, like I needed to catch them, like, a 50th or 60th place finish, what are you going to do for me? Like, I needed to catch them well. And I really thought the only place I could catch them obviously well was in a Pocka. And based off my practice, I said, man, if I just get 35, 40 minutes in a Pocka, I'm going to catch what I need. And so my game plan was at 9 o'clock, if I don't have 10 pounds, because it, you know, it's no secret Harris Chain's been fishing pretty tough for the last year. And I was, so I had a number in my head. If I didn't have 10 pounds, 10 or 11 pounds by 9 o'clock, I was going to roll. And hopefully whoever had went through to Apaca was out and I could at least go check it and see if I could get through the lock. And at 8:30, I catch one right at 8 pounds. Well, that was it. Like, I ain't leaving. Like, I'm going to scrounge out a limit, you know, to go with this 8 pounder. And that's what I wound up doing. I went and caught a limit. Primarily on the chatterbait. And at the end of the day, I came back into Big Harris and I caught another one right at 8 pounds, which gave me a big bag, gave me, I think, 22 pounds. And of course, we rolled and went into the weigh-in. But what's crazy, and that's touring on the road, touring has taught me this. And I think it's the difference. Like, you see guys all the time that are local hammers and whatnot. And when you get out on the road, that's the difference in a touring pro and a local hammer is basically just being able to make adjustments on the fly. Because when you're on your home pond, you know, you kind of know, you've seen that scenario enough on your home pond that you know what to do. You know, and when to make that change. So there on day two, I go out and man, I started the shad spawn again, trying to do the shad spawn again, and the area was trashed again. So I just swapped areas of the lake and I just started running around. Well, I pulled up and picked up an epic swim jig, and right off the bat, I busted, I think, like a 4.5 and then a 2, like back to back fish. And I mean, it wound up good on that, but what's crazy is I never caught a fish on a swim jig on day one, not one single fish on a swim jig. And on day two, I did. I mean, I caught whatever I had. I caught just about my whole bag on day two. I caught a clutch 5 pounder at the end of the day, but I probably caught, once I caught that 5 pounder, man, I bet I caught, I don't know, 20 keepers probably on a swim jig in about an hour. So I mean, of course, if you put a swim jig in my hand, dude, that's my drug. Like, I love that. So
you weren't having any fun. No fun with that.
No, it was terrible. I mean, it was a terrible time. I wouldn't advise that for anybody at all. It's horrible. It'll make you hate bass fishing, getting bit on a swim jig. But yeah, I mean, it was, I had to change every day, really. You know, I mean, that was the whole deal. And then of course I made it, I made the cut, went to day three, and you know, John was catching them, and I knew he was going to catch them. You know, I mean, he was consistent, and I felt like I knew I could catch them, but I wasn't going to catch enough, you know? And so like I've always, and I'm going to say probably most professionals think the way I think that do it for a living. And, but there's some that don't, but most guys, if they ever smell blood, you know, if they think they got a chance, you know, tenth's the worst you could do, you know, which is what I did. But I mean, that's the worst you can do. Once you make it to day four, I mean, that's it. So anyway, I went to Apaca days three and I had an opportunity. I really did. They bit a little bit. It was nothing like it was in practice. I just think that storm had just trashed that whole lake. But I did have an opportunity at two big fish, and I actually broke one of them off and the other one pulled off. And that's the thing about Florida. It's the same thing to St. John's. When you get around those big fish in Florida, I've noticed this over the years, you can literally drop your raptors. And because it happened to me in both spots, both lakes, you can drop your raptors and you could catch 30 pounds and never pick them up. You know, and then that's what's so crazy. I'm talking about within, you know, 180 degrees, you know, casting around. It's like when they get in an area, it's like it's biggins and it's all biggins, you know. And then you can go for a half a mile or three quarters of a mile and never get a bite, you know. They're just not there, or you'll catch a couple of rats, you know. And that's the thing about Florida, and I guess that's why I do well there. I understand that first off, you got to get bites. Like you can say that for all lakes, but Florida's a different animal. You're either around some fish or you ain't around nothing, you know, whereas you can go right. A lot of lakes, let's say a lake with some docks or whatever. I mean, you really ain't got a, you know, you're not really around a group of fish. You just fish in docks and hope you get 5 or 10 or 15 bites or whatever. You know, I mean, that's, Florida's not that away. I mean, the vegetation looks the same. Everything looks the same, but that's how I grew up. We were just talking about Caddo Lake. So you learn from a young age. That's where experience, in my opinion, comes in on that kind of stuff. Instinctual fishing. You know, everything looks the same to some people and maybe to most people, but it don't look the same to everybody. You know, people that, right, that have grown up doing that, they see the little small differences, you know, and that's, you know, I've picked up on that throughout my life. I mean, I fished what we call buck brush around here. You know, I mean, I flip buck brush, flip cypress trees. But I mean, there's difference in bushes, believe it or not. You know, not, you may look at it and it just looks like a mile of bushes, you know, going down the bank, but it ain't all the same. You know, now to, right, most people that have never seen it, it all looks the same. But it's not. And the same can probably more than likely be said. In fact, I know it can be said, you know, for smallmouth fishing up north. You know, I mean, stuff's different. You know, like for me, a lot of it all looked the same. You know, but I know for guys that live up there, I mean, they know to look for the veins. They know, you know, they know what to look for, you know, in the rocks and all that kind of stuff, and the, you know, the sand mixed in. I mean, they know what they're looking for and that stuff. And of course, you know, I'm learning and continue to learn that, which is basically what I've done down here over the years. I've just learned that, you know, there's little things inside those big things where it all looks the same. And when you figure that out, and you key in on that, it makes the lake fish a lot smaller, which is a good thing at that point in time. It's not overwhelming. You know what I mean? Like, it don't, right, just, it's not 9,000 pencil reeds or 9,000 flat reeds or, you know, different types of pads and all that kind of stuff. And that's really what I did at both of those events. You know, once I picked up on what they were setting up on and how they were setting up, and the baits that they wanted. You know, that's the other thing. You've got to figure out what they'll eat, because they'll always, you know, you can catch them on a lot of different baits a lot of times, but there's always one particular bait that they want, more so than the others. And when you get dialed in on that, you know, you can crack a big bag. But, you know, you're also still at the mercy. You know, big fish are just like big deer. Like you said, these deer behind me, I mean, they're just like big deer. They're not stupid. I believe that. Like, people won't say, oh, fish are stupid. No, they're not either. I don't believe it. Now, I mean, anybody can be stupid on any particular day. I mean, that's why we have the rut and deer get killed.
Right.
But fish are not stupid, not big ones. They aren't. I mean, forward facing sonar will show you that. If you don't believe it, I mean, you can get out there and look at 2 pounders and you can catch the fire out of them. You throw it up, you know, a big one, it's a 6 or 8 pounder. And I mean, you know, chase that sucker around to get him to bite, you know? So, I mean, it's just, it shows you that, you know, that's kind of opened our eyes to that. But I've always known that. I mean, them big ones aren't dumb, and you really are at the mercy of them, either on figuring out what'll trigger them or when that little time frame is that they're going to bite, you know? And that's the game you play. It's a dynamite, you know, it can blow up in your face, or it can be good. Because, you know, and typically in Florida, if you've watched, and you know, obviously you have, I mean, I'm talking about anybody that's watched it. I mean, Florida is generally, you see big bags down there. I mean, it's generally one or two fish that make that bag. You know, it's not like if a guy has 21 pounds or whatever, I'm not going to say that it doesn't happen, because it does, but it rarely does he have 5 4-pounders. You know what I mean? Or if he's got 29 pounds, he don't have 5 right at 6 pounds. You know, I mean, that's just Florida 101. That's the way it works. But if, you know, if you're around 3 pound, I would say, class fish, 3 to 4 pound fish, you're around 7 and 8 pounders too. I mean, that's just, yeah, in Florida. They're there.
So to break this down a little bit, like when you're backtracking, when you were mentioning, to some people, they look at it and they see a lake of just reeds all over the bank, where you can see something different, where it might be just a flat line of reeds, where some, it might be reeds that have a couple isolated patches that are outside of it that might look a little bit different. But talk about, like, of a lake like Florida, you go into it, it looks like just a bowl with a bunch of reeds around. What are some of the telltale signs or first clues you might see that might look different or might pop out at you first to say that I'm going to catch one flipping there, I'm going to catch one there? Like, what are some of the things that stand out to you in a field that all looks, might look the same to people?
So the first thing that I always look for, is whatever is a, is the least available. And so, like, if you've got, let's just say, you say you're in a huge pad field. Okay. And, you know, and then there's just, isolated, little pennywort mats, or isolated pencil reeds, or isolated flat reeds, or whatever, but there's not as many of it. And that's not just Florida. I mean, that's down south in general. You're trying to find, that's the first thing I'm going to look for, is I'm going to try to find whatever is, you know, the least vegetation. Like, it's not the most abundant thing. You know, it just seems to attract them. What I found really was different this time than February when we were there in the past is I caught the majority of my fish, if not all of them, really, probably in February on pencil reeds. And I caught them in a total different section of the lake. And we're still talking about Harris Chain here. And then, of course, when I went to went back this time, I mean, they were on a total different type of reed. You know, I mean, it wasn't a pencil reed. Now, the thing that was different that I, and I'll say that this is probably one of the only times I've ever seen this. You know, anything that's isolated is always going to be good, obviously. Cypress tree. I mean, I learned that from cypress trees years ago. You know, I mean, if you got an isolated cypress tree, your percentage goes up, obviously, on getting bit on that tree. But for the first, this was one of the few times that I saw that you can also generally tell if they're in or out. And what I mean by that is if they're on the outer edges of the cover, or if they're on what I consider like the hard line of the cover, whatever your hard line is. And I couldn't do that this time. And that was one of the rare times in my life that I can remember that I could catch a 7-pounder on the hard line just as well as I could on an isolated patch. And I can't tell you why that is. I really don't know. I mean, of course, nobody knows. We don't all have, there are no perfect answers to bass fishing.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's no written book. Which is what keeps us all going in. And I mean, if it was that easy to figure out, I've said this for years. If I caught a 10-pounder every time I went to the lake, I wouldn't do this crap. There's no way. Yeah. I mean, it sounds crazy to say that, you know, failure, but dude, failure builds character. Failure makes you appreciate winning at any level. I don't care what it is. I mean, if I won every single time that I went out, I wouldn't do it. You know, I mean, and so like if you take, and I know, I'll ramble on and get completely off subject, but like if you take, I don't care what the sport is, it can be Little League Baseball, but if you're just fishing, you're fishing Tuesday nighters. Well, if you're dominating Tuesday nighters, you know, you're going to move up and you're going to fish, whatever, you know, BFLs. If you're dominating BFLs, you're going to move up to coasters. I mean, if you have that competitive nature in you, you know, because I mean, I'm not going to say that I seek failure because nope, that's not the case. I've had enough of it on tour. But I've said this a lot of times too, throughout my life. I've won a lot of tournaments, you know, regionally, locally in the area that I live. And there's been a lot of times where I've won those tournaments where I didn't really learn anything, to be honest with you. And I really don't even know why I won them. I mean, as far as what the fish were doing, they don't make sense. But there's been a ton of them that I haven't won that I've lost. And I actually learned more from those tournaments than the ones that I did where I, you know, where I won. That sounds crazy, but it's the truth. You learn a lot through failure a lot of times. So, and failure, mm-hmm. You know, I'm talking about if you ain't finishing, you know, it's old Ricky Bobby, if you ain't first, you're last, you know. But I mean, if it's the truth, you know, but I do, you learn a lot from it. But, you know, as far as like that cover too, you know, another thing I look for, like in Florida, you know, obviously it's the isolated stuff, is what you're going to start. You're going to look at the different, you know, and it just so happened to be reeds at Harris Chain, but that's not the deal at St. John's, or it wasn't for me, you know, this time around, but you're looking for a big root system too. You know, that's something that I look for. That's what makes a cypress tree special. You know, that's right. What separates a cypress tree from any other cypress tree. If you could drain the water and actually see that, which we have, you know, technology now that you can see all that. But for years, like, you know, you just had this special cypress tree that, you know, you always caught them off of, and you're like, why do you catch them off that one? You know, well, it's because of the root system. You know, there's something that root system is unique. There's probably holes in it, you know, that hold a lot of, you know, hold a lot of brim, hold a lot of, you know, whatever, to get in it. But that's the same thing with those, with, you know, with pads. Because the pads that grow in Florida are not the same pad. Like, we have what I call flat pads, and what I mean is they lay flat on the water. And you've got dollar pads and stuff like that in Florida, but those pads in Florida, they're like a damn bush, really. I mean, they grow up out of the water in a cluster. Yeah, I mean, it's a dang cluster. So I look at that. When I see that, I look at it like I'm flipping a bush, you know, or I'm swimming a jig by a bush. So that's kind of how I picture that and how I look at that. But that's you know, reeds, pads, whatever. I'm trying to see if I see a cluster that, because a lot of that stuff you can see based off of the stalks, you know, that come out of it. If it has a bigger root system to it, then I know that, you know, my odds go up to, you know, to make a flip in that, you know, in that vicinity.
Yeah. And so with that, from your standpoint, you know, practice wise, when you're going and say you're visiting a Popka and looking for that flipping bite, are you typically, and this is like specifically for tournament anglers, is that, and you know that, you know, maybe you'll run into two, maybe three bites throughout a multi-day tournament of big bites.
Right.
Are you setting the hook at all in practice, or are you shaking everything off? Because that's a whole different bite than finding a shell bar where you might have, you know, usually it'll be more numbers.
Yeah, you know, so I'll tell you this. I do, obviously, when I first get bit, I set the hook. Because, I mean, there's a lot of different freaking fish that live in Florida, you know, I mean, and they all bite. I mean, there's all kinds of crap down there. And I got a funny story. Like, Tyler Rivette rooms with us, and I remember one time on St. John's, like, dude, he thought he was freaking on them, son. I'm talking about on them. Shaking them off right and left, and he goes down there for the day of the derby, and it ain't nothing but mudfish. I mean, they're all mudfish. He done shook off 20 mudfish in practice, you know. So, I mean, you got to set the hook some. But, for example, at Apaca, the first day of practice, I got there. I mean, I had two big ones right off the bat, and then, I started shaking them off, and then I just left the area. And then I went 6 hours without a bite. I never had a bite, not a single bite. And, it, you know, it's a big, Paco's big. That sucker's not a little bitty lake. And I never had a bite. And that's the thing with Florida, you know, I mean, there's generally a bunch of them in a little area, even though it all looks the same as far as vegetation. And really all you could do on that, I mean, there again, now I'm still using what I told you as far as the bigger root systems and the little points or whatever that's different, but I've got that trolling motor on high until I find, you know, where I start getting bit, and I'll set the hook the first time or two, you know, when I start getting bit, and then of course I'll start shaking them off, and then once I'm getting, you know, several bites, like I keep the trolling motor on high, and I'm probably only hitting you know, a tenth of what I think is holding fish, and as long as I'm still getting bit. Because you got to kind of, you know, it's a different deal. Like, for example, in Apaca, that's a different place than, say, if I was fishing Harris Chain. Like, at Harris Chain, I won't spend as much time. Like, if I was on a flipping bite, for example, in Harris Chain, I wouldn't spend as much time. I say Harris Chain. If I'm in Big Harris, I wouldn't spend as much time, like, trying to figure out where they start and where they end on the bites is what I mean, like the area. I know I can figure that out during the tournament. I've got time. But Apaca, right, you don't have time to figure that out, because you really don't know when you take off every morning how many people are locking, you know, what's the lock situation going to be like. So, like, when I went into that deal thinking I was flight one, my mindset was, I knew when I got there is how many bites can I get in 3 hours? because that's just what I look at. Like, that's what I'm going to probably get. Now, I mean, if everything goes wonderful, you might get 5.5 hours to fish, but how many bites can you get in 3 hours? Because that's tournament situation. That's what you're looking at, is a 3 hour window at best. A lot of times you might only have an hour, you know, like I said, it just depends. You never know what curveball is going to be thrown your way. But so when I practice over there, I practice a little different. I keep the trolling motor on high. Like I said, as long as I'm getting bit. And now once I notice like I'm starting to not get bit as much, then I will slow down and actually start to pick it apart a little better, just to verify and make sure that, okay, that I'm out of them. Because when I get there tournament day, I don't have time to break it down and figure out where they're at. Now, I mean, I may have to figure out if they've gotten off of a bait or whatever, you know, but as far as where they're living at, you better know where they live when you get there. Because if you don't know where they live, you're in trouble. You know, I mean, so you can't just go over there and say, well, you know, like a normal place, well, I had 6 or 8 bites in here. You know, I'll figure it out in the Derby, which is what you know, what we all normally do. But you can't do that, in my opinion. You better know where they live, and you, I mean, you better land on them, and you better start catching them. And that's really, you know, I don't care where you go. I mean, that's anywhere you're making a long run or you know, you have several locks or whatever, because I've done it my whole career. I mean, I've done it on the Red River. I've run for long, you know, Winyah Bay. Like, Winyah Bay is a good example. I mean, you better know where they're at when you get there. You ain't got time to figure them out, you know. So it's those are just examples, you know, of there's different, you know, the way I practice different depending on the situation, you know, that I know I'm going into. Right. But yeah, like day 3 and 4, I mean, dude, I didn't have anything to lose. Like, I knew John was going to catch them. You know, he'd showed that all week. And so I needed some big bags, and I couldn't catch them. I couldn't win. I mean, I could have stayed, you know, close and caught whatever, you know, 12, 15, 16 pounds. I don't know, but I wasn't going to catch 20 something pounds. And I knew in Apaca, you know, you could catch 30 something pounds. It's possible there. So that's the reason I went. And of course, you know, I mean, I got my teeth kicked in both days over there, and we all know finishing 10th, but I was fine with that because, you know, the way I look at it, dude, you ain't never, I mean, I ain't gonna say never, because you can win when, you know, just by fluke type stuff sometimes, but most times if you ain't trying to win, you're not going to win. And, you know, I haven't won nationally, obviously, but nothing's going to change on the way that I approach that situation. Like, I probably, like I said, probably could have stayed and might would have finished, you know, 4 or 5 places higher in the event, but I really didn't care about that. You know, yeah, I mean, it was a few thousand dollars more, but, you know, what's a few thousand dollars versus $100,000 and a blue trophy, you know, because that's really the end goal, you know, for anybody that's doing this. So, yeah, I didn't, you know, it didn't work out. I didn't catch them. Same, you know, same thing in St. John's. It didn't work out, but one day it will work out. I have faith in that. I've done it too many times, you know, living where I live around here. I mean, the stars, and, you know, like, you know, it did on day 3 at St. John's, and it very cool, you know, very well could have on day 4. And then I give Corey a run for his money, you know, if I catch another big bag like that, I'm at least going to scare the hell out of him, you know. So, I mean, that's, and I knew I was around those kind of fish, you know, at the St. John's and at Apaca. But they just did not bite. It didn't materialize for me. They didn't bite. And that's part of it. You know, that's the game we play. But I don't have any regrets on that. Like I said, as far as, you know, top 10, hey, it was good. I needed the daggum points. You know, I mean, they got me some good points. Come out of there with good shit, you know, and rolled on to the next one, you know, at St. John's.
Yeah. So to go back on one of the things you mentioned about putting raptors down, you can catch 30 pounds like in that instant.
Yeah.
When you're, say, whether you're in tournament mode or whatever it may be, this could be for any case, but when you're going into an area and you think it's high percentage, are you putting raptors down immediately or are you putting them down once you get bit? Like, are you going to keep moving until you get bit?
So that's a good question, really. And I don't know that I have the correct answer for it. in a practice mode, probably no. I probably don't put them down because I'm on high a lot of times until I get bit. But if I'm in a tournament mode, and especially if I have any history, and when I say history, I don't mean necessarily history with the area, but it could just be history with the type of vegetation that they've bit on the day before or 2 days before. You know what I mean? Like, if I see something that's high percentage that I really feel like that's where I'm going to get bit, you know, I'm going to drop them before I get there and try to pick it apart. That's the whole thing. I'll put them down before I get there. And that's really, which I'll let you lead into that. I'm not going to jump into the subject, but I mean, that's what I did at St. John's.
Right. Yeah. I think that's one thing you'd hit on it earlier. You think that some guys might miss that, those small little areas like you're talking about, where I can put my Raptors down and I can flip a section for maybe it's 30 minutes or longer and catch that big bag, or some guys might catch that one fish, make a couple flips, but they're still on the motor going down the bank and they might miss that whole window right there. Right. I think that might be one of the bigger culprits for guys that might catch a big one, but then miss that. There might be that gem right there in that section.
Yeah, that's very, very possible. You know, I mean, if you, you know, and I notice I've watched people, cause I do a lot of, like instructional stuff around here where I live at. And one of the things I try to teach, like the kids and stuff that are doing this, you know, one of the things I'll ask them, when they get a bite, you know, when they get bit, well, what did you notice? You know, what was different? What made you get that bite? Why was that fish? The number one question is, why was that fish there? You know, and I think that's what people, and a lot of them can't answer. You know, they just got bit. They don't know what it was, you know, and that's where, you know, we go into the whole learning phase, you know, and try to understand why that fish was, you know, was set up like it was. And yeah, so I mean, I watched that happen, obviously, from, you know, from the youth, you know, trying to learn, you know, and that's from everybody. I mean, that's what you do. You have to learn it. You know, I mean, you're just not going to, you don't just step out there and know that, as far as instinctual fishing. But that's a good question. And I think probably a lot of people do. They probably keep going, you know, and they don't pay attention to that. You know, of why that fish was there. And it can all still be the same looking vegetation or cover or whatever it is that you're fishing. You know, like, for example, at the St. John, like where I caught them on day 2, I didn't catch them on day 3. You know, the fish moved on me. And I was actually, I said it on stage, I was actually leaving the area. Like, I had the trolling motor on high. I mean, I was rolling out. And I literally said, I said, good Lord, if you don't show me one pretty quick, I said, I'm finna have to burn out of here. Cause I'm not getting bit. And I kid you not, within 30 seconds, I catch one almost 6 pounds. And that'll when do. She ate it, huh?
So that'll do.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, when she ate it, I mean, I instantly dropped the wrappers, and I kid you not, I put her in a live well and I stand up and I don't make 2 casts and I catch 8.5, you know, and then I have one between 8 and 9, the very next cast, jump over my jig, you know? So, I mean, it was like, I had 31. I know this sounds crazy. People think, yeah, whatever. But I mean, and that's swim jig fishing 101. I mean, it happens. That's the way it is. But if everything would have actually bit that I saw that day, I mean, 40 ain't out of the question. I mean, there was that many big ones, you know, in the area. Just couldn't, yeah. You know, they don't all bite. That's part of it. You know, I mean, you're not going to catch all of them. But
real fast before you continue with that, Justin Largen, who's part of our podcast network here, as asking for that swim jig, are you steady retrieving that thing down in Florida? Are you Alabama shaking it? It's a hybrid of both. What's your go-to with that?
Yeah. So that's a different deal. I want you to imagine this, because this is really the best way I think to describe that. Okay. I'm fishing that swim jig like you would fish a square bill. So if you think about a square bill, your object when you're around cover, let's say laydowns, docks, whatever it is that you're trying to do, you're trying to deflect that square bill off of something to trigger that bite, you know, even if it's riprap, you know, I mean, you know, when you're cranking down riprap, I mean, you're getting a deflection and a reaction bite. And so, like you're talking about the high stick Alabama shake, you know, keeping that bait high in the water column, which is what we do around here where I live 95% of the time. But that's not what I was doing in Florida. I was reeling it along at a pretty good clip, but the weather made me do that. And what I mean by that is it was slick. Like, dude, the wind didn't blow for 5 or 6 days. Like, it was slick, slick, slick conditions. And I just felt like they were getting too good a look at it, you know, like say with a 3/8 or something. Yeah. And so I went to a half ounce and just try to burn that bait through there where they either got to eat it or get out of the way. You know, I mean, that's their two options. And so that's really what I was doing with that though. I mean, I was basically throwing a square bill. You know, that's the mindset of how I was using it to get that bite off those stems is basically what I was doing.
That's pretty dang cool. That's probably gonna blow a couple people's minds in regards to throwing that swim jig, because I think a lot of people look at a swim jig, and maybe it's just me. I could be overshadowed with it because I don't throw it all that often up here. But a lot of them are like, yeah, it's either you're shaking it or, you know, there's a little bit of the whole Mississippi River, you know, slow rolling it on bottom type of deal, but right. There's not a lot of that, you know, where you're talking where you bump into a reed clump and kill it type of deal, or it's,
yeah,
that's pretty niche.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, cool. It was definitely a little, you know, a little bit different, you know, and I've done that here, where I live, at times I have. And you know, and in Florida, I'm sure, you know, high, what I call high stick in Alabama shake and whatever, keeping it high in the water column where it's a visual bite. You know, I'm sure that's a big thing in Florida as well. You know, it just so happened that the way I was catching them this time, most of them, that's not how I was catching them. I had it coming along at a good clip. I mean, but I think, you know, I don't think I know what made me do that. Like I said, was the weather. You know, if I would have had cloudiness or whatever, I'd have had, you know, more power fishing conditions, I probably would not have been reeling it near as fast. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I really feel like probably would have actually tricked more of them, you know, got more of them to bite. But that just was, you know, wasn't a card we was dealt. And I've just learned that over the years. I mean, that's just power fishing 101. I mean, a lot of times you got to make them bite, you know, and even with that said, you're still only going to get 1 out of 10 to actually eat it. When you're dealt those slick conditions or, you know, what I consider not great fishing conditions, you got to figure out a way to, if they're there and you know they're there, you got to figure out a way to trick some of them. And like that, you know, where I was fishing, you know, at St. John's, like I knew, you know, would it have been great to catch 5 of them? Yeah, absolutely. You know, but I knew, you know, of those great big ones like that I knew were there. But in reality, like you get 2 of those a day, you got a good bag, and that's what you're fishing for. I mean, you're trying to get 2 of those big ones, and then, you know, just figure lemon out with solid fish, you know, whatever you can get to bite. But 2 7-8 pounders, you know, whatever, they go, you know, they go a long ways, and you know, in a stringer.
No kidding. Yeah. Especially in Florida. Yeah. So to that point, I got 1 or 2 things on St. John's River, because I think you covered it pretty well. And then we'll let you go here. But one of the more questions I have just in regard to general, you know, flipping things like that is whether this is tournament or not, you know, it could be in practice and you find a good area that you're catching them flipping, or it's fun fishing. You know, you go one day and you catch them flipping in an area, and then the next day there's wind blowing on that exact spot. Pretty good. You know, when you go, either you're going back to that to fish in a tournament or you're going to back, you know, just to fish in general. You know, is it more cases than not that that's not going to happen? Like, if you think it's manageable to fish, is it worth going to, or is that place pretty much dead because of that wind?
You know, I think that all depends on the cover that those fish are using and how long has that wind been blowing? in there? Like, you know, did that start at midnight? Has it been ripping in there for 6 hours? I know that's a simple question, but it's a broader question really too. You know, I right. mean, it's how long have you had those, you know, those weather conditions? And like, for example, I'll just speak bushes, for example, like if you're fishing bushes, you know, flipping bushes, what I've learned over the years is those fish, in my opinion, don't like those bushes rubbing on them. And so if you've got waves crashing in it, I think they pull out of them, you know. Now I'm not going to say you can't catch them. You just may not be able to flip them. You know, you might have right. to, you might have to pick up a spinner bait or, you know, a chatter bait or whatever it is that you, you know, that you want to throw. And then again, sometimes they just don't bite. I mean, that's just the reality of it, that, you know, they were flipping fish alone. Like that's all they would eat. You couldn't catch them any other way. And they still remain that way, even with the weather condition. They're just no longer in the bush. You know, that's just my opinion on it. And a pad cluster is the same way. You know, I mean, you know, I feel like fish don't like stuff rubbing on them. That's just my, you know, my opinion on that. I'm not saying that's the truth or whatever. But I think when them waves start crashing in, and it starts moving all that stuff around, you know, it just, you could imagine if somebody was throwing phantom punches at you 24/7. You know, like if every time you turn, I mean, you're just looking, throwing phantom punches right and left. I mean, you ain't going to sit there very long. You're fixing to move or you're fixing to whoop somebody, one of the two. You know, I mean, you ain't going to sit there and deal with that. So, I mean, I feel like those fish are the same way. I mean, they're, you know, it puts them on edge. They don't like it. So I think they move around. You know, I think they get out of that stuff. But that's just my take on it.
Yeah. Well, and to that, I guess to expand on that, like say with bushes, you don't find that they're in there. Do you find more cases than not that they're going to be close by, or do you pretty much write off that area and go to somewhere that's not getting wind blown?
I'm going to try, you know, I'm probably going to pick up, like I said, a moving bait and try to fish the outer edge. But I won't spend a lot of time. I won't spend a lot of time on it because it seems like a lot of times that area just gets, it just gets trashed and, you know, they just don't bite. I don't think they don't swim out of the country. You know, I just think they just get out of that stuff and they just don't bite. You just can't catch them. Which is kind of similar to what happened to me at the Harris chain. You know, like I had a shad spawn area, you know, which is in Kissimmee grass. I mean, they were spawning in it and I couldn't catch them. I mean, I just could not catch them. I mean, maybe I could have, if it was my only spot, and I had nothing else to go to, you know, I might would have possibly figured it out. I don't know, but I had too many areas to run around and try to find something that wasn't getting trashed, you know? And so, I mean, you know, a little wind is always good, you know, like, you know, you've heard the saying before, you know, the wind's your friend. I mean, a little bit of wind is always good, but you get too much. I mean, and it'll track, like now if you're fishing offshore, I mean, if we're ledge fish, I mean, I love the ledge fish, you know, I mean, I'm not just a shallow guy, I fish offshore all the time. I mean, but, if you're ledge fishing, I mean, hell, I want all the wind I can get, you know, the rougher, the better, you know, I mean, I think it, you know, it stirs that bait up, you know, and makes them bite. But not in that shallow cover. I don't like it, for the most part. I'm probably going to pack my bags and I'm going to roll and try to find somewhere that's not getting trashed.
Yeah. Okay. So I got one last question for you on the flipping deal, specifically towards what you were doing on St. John's River. And then I got one, at least a show ending question for you before we let you go here. And that is with the pads and things that you were seeing that you're talking about earlier on St. John's River. When you got a place like that, that's got them in the canals, it's got them in these, you know, backwater ponds, and it's got them everywhere. What are you going to key in on? What is something like that when people just see pads for ages? You know, what is something that's like a telltale sign that stands out to you that these fish might key in on more when they have pads forever?
So in this situation of when we went down there this time, I think you kind of need to look for what you feel like or you know, because there were still some fish, obviously, you know, and of course in the springs, I think they spawn a lot, you know, like it's almost dang near never ending. But there's some fish, you know, that are still spawning, but I probably feel like, let's just say at least 65-70% of the fish had, you know, had already spawned. And I know they spawn multiple times down there, but, I think you need to look for, you know, me personally, when I went down there this time, I wasn't looking for spawners, which is why I got to, you know, finish second and not first. I got the break speed off of it by Corey, but, I was you know, primarily looking for either, you know, shad spawn eaters or brim eaters. And I looked for spawning areas where I felt like those fish had spawned recently. And then I look for, you know, cause those brim are going to spawn around those pad edges somewhere. And if you want to just know how to find them, you know, one thing, you can smell them, spawning. But another thing, I mean, if you're on, you've got the trolling motor on high or whatever, and you're just going out of bank literally on high, I mean, you know, Mega 360 shows a broom bed plain, as plain as it gets. Yeah. You know, I mean, you can't, if you can, if you, you really need to get your eyes checked if you can't see it on that. So, but I mean, that's really what I was keying on, and that's kind of what I look for. I look for those areas where I knew the fish had spawned. And once I, you know, we had a short practice there too, so that changes a lot of things, you know. But I looked for where the fish had, you know, I felt like it spawned, and then I try to find, you know, the nearest pad field around those areas and try it. Now, I mean, you're going to strike out on that a lot of times, you know. I mean, it's not all good, but when you find the right one, you know, I mean, you can get right in a hurry. It don't take long when you find them, because I mean, those brim eaters, you know, that's exactly what they are. They're there to eat, you know, and that's what I was trying to find. You know, I was trying to find fish that had spawned or non spawning. Now that's not, you know, obviously not what I do when I'm there in February. I'm fishing for spawners. But I'm not a sight guy either too. I mean, I can catch a sight fish obviously just like anybody else, but it's not my deal. Like I don't like it as much. Now, I mean, I've caught a million fish off the bed that I couldn't see. You know, I mean, I'm still fishing for spawning fish. I know obviously what I'm looking for and where I feel like I've, you know, that's where a bed should be, you know, and of course, you know, and you catch them, you know, off the bed, but you, I can't see them, you know, I mean, gotcha. That's just me. I like to fish, you know, which I come up in a dirty water situation, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I've bed fished, you know, a lot in my life, but I've flipped dirty lakes all my life and, you know, and you learn where, and it's no different. I don't care if you're in Florida or whatever. I mean, you learn where they spawn at, and we know what to look for, and then you just slow down. You know, that's what you do. I mean, it sounds crazy, but I've done it on the St. John's before. I sat on an area one time at the St. John's and did well in the tournament. I was actually fishing reeds that time. Dude, I bet it wasn't 150. No, that's probably there. It's probably 250 yards long, and I fished it for 7 hours. Never left. That's awesome. 7 hours, and caught a pretty good bag, and should have had a really monster bag. Just had a couple things go wrong, but you know, like literally, I mean, I'd pick the Raptors up, and I'm only picking them up like just, you know, till the fiberglass pole just barely, just, you know, comes out of the ground, and just let the wind just, you know, carry me a few feet just to where I can reach, you know, what I couldn't reach flipping early, and then drop them again and pick it. You know, now those are spawning fish. You know, I can't see them. But when you find where they're coming to or whatever on an area like that, on something like that, I mean, you just slow down, take your time, you know, when they're spawning. But when they're not spawning like this time, and that's why, I mean, I did a lot, you know, the majority of my damage was done with, you know, with a swim jig, with an epic swim jig. And that was the whole deal was, you know, those fish were aggressive. You know, we're in April. They're a lot more aggressive. They're not protecting anything. They're there to eat. They're there to eat brim. And so that's pretty much what I targeted this time.
Yeah, and I wanted to pick up one thing that you mentioned. I don't know if you meant this literally, and if you did, I'm about to lose my mind here. But you said you could smell the fish spawning?
You can smell brim spawning, yeah.
God, yeah, I've heard from like a saltwater sense, like you can smell and see like bait slicks.
You see oil slicks. Absolutely. You can do that offshore, largemouth. Now, it's not as prevalent as it used to be, you know, but let's say before everybody in the world learned how to use side imaging and, you know, of course, the phenomenal Lake Master that, you know, that we have now. In other words, when the offshore stuff was only getting touched by your real old, you know, your old OGs, like I'm talking about the old dudes on the lake. Yeah. Like they knew, you know, they knew where that offshore stuff was. Probably helped most of them seen the lake built. I mean, they were old dudes, you know, or they had old paper maps of, you know, what the lake was like before it was built. So, you know, they knew those old spots before you had side imaging and all that kind of stuff. And I, you know, even I myself remember, with that being said, I mean, I can still remember the days of when I've seen those, you know, when offshore fishing was just getting started. I remember seeing those oil slicks, you know, and it's shad slicks. What do you, I mean, in other words, they're gorging on those shads so much that there is literally oil on top of the water. And when you saw that, it was game over. I mean, I'm talking about pull the split rings off the crankbait. I mean, it's just, it's stupid, you know, but the brim, like I said, yes, you can smell the brim too, you know, when you get in certain areas that you know, and the wind's right. I mean, hell, it ain't no different deer hunt. You smell a rutting buck. You know, anybody spending time in the woods hunting, you can smell that buck, you know. So, but that, you know, that's just being in nature, spending time in the outdoors. You know, you learn, pick up on all kinds of things.
That's freaking cool. I can't say, I may have experienced it, but it had never like hit me. But that is right. That's something I'm going to look out for now is I'm going to see some brim spawning and I'm going to be like, I'm start sniffing around now. I mean, like,
you guys start sniffing around.
Yeah.
Get downwind of it. You know, get downwind of it and see if you can start to smell it, you know. But that's the truth. I mean, and like you're talking about with the slicks offshore, but I mean, it's the same thing with ledge fishing. I mean, I've seen those largemouth feed on those sheds so heavy that there is literally a film on top of the water of the oil. You know, that comes out of the shed, I guess, you know, from just destroying them. But I hadn't seen that in a long time, you know, because those fish are smart now. They've been pounded on for years. But
yeah,
I did. I saw it years ago. Sure did.
That's freaking cool, man. Well, man, I got one last question for you to wrap the show up. Similar to how we led this thing off, we like to wrap it up, anybody that's new to the show, with this question. And that is, if you could choose three individuals, they don't have to be in the fishing industry. They could be alive now or alive 1,000 years ago. Doesn't matter. It can be anybody. Three different people that you would love to sit down, have a steak, have a beer, and pick their brain. Who are you going to choose?
Three different people. I'd probably take Tom Brady. I'd like to sit down and talk to him. See how he stayed so strong for so long, dominant. I've never actually got to sit down with Kevin, so I'd like to sit down with Van Damme, talk to him.
All right.
And then probably, I don't even know. I'm trying to think of somebody else, something that's not really even in the industry. Maybe you probably know what I'm talking about when I say this, but probably General Patton, World War II. I'd probably like to talk to that dude.
That's probably one of the coolest answers we've ever gotten on the show.
I mean, Stone Cold killer, so I'd probably like to talk to that dude just to see his mindset.
He's probably got some stories for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Well, that's cool, man. As we wrap this up, I guess one last thing. Give folks, like, if your go-to flipping setup for something like that, if you had one rod, reel, line, bait, everything that you could go to flip anywhere in the country, what you going to pick up?
I've actually got a rod that I designed for Castaway, and it's a 7.3 heavy, and it's really kind of an all-purpose rod, because I get asked that question a lot, you know, especially from kids, you know, like, man, what rod do I need? And I think you take that 7.3 Castaway heavy, and you can do pretty much anything with it. I mean, I flip with it, I frog with it, I swim jig with it. I actually built it for swim jigging and frogging. But I'd probably take that rod, and I would take like a 5/16 weight with a bass ass and a little skunk ape, which is just a little glide type flipping bait. And then if it allows 50-pound braid with I don't have any, like, I'm not sponsored by a reel company or nothing, but I, you know, people ask all the time, what's the best reel for the money? In my opinion, I mean, you can get an SLX for $99, dude. I think that's a great reel.
Hell yeah, bro. That's awesome. Well, dude, seriously, thank you so much for taking the time out and hopping on here. Definitely want to get you back on here again soon, because I think we have many tangents that we can go on that we need to go on the show.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love to talk. So anytime you need somebody to talk, just give me a shout.
Heck yeah, man. Well, appreciate it. And great job on the Florida Swing. We'll be rooting for you to keep that going on Murray here in a couple weeks. And we'll be talking to you again real soon.
All right, man. I appreciate you having me.
All right. We'll see you, Brad. There you have it, folks. Mr. Brad Watley, the best handlebar in fishing. But super cool. A lot of really good tips there. And I don't know. I would love to hear from you guys, especially that are tuning in here. Have you ever smelled brim spawning? That was one of the coolest things that I took from that. But a lot of nuggets in there, a lot of things to learn from, especially in an age where we're talking about, you know, lines getting lighter, baits are getting more finesse. Talking about a guy that's getting it done with big line, doing it his way and having fun with it. And that's freaking cool. And that's something we really wanted to shine on this show. And I know these next two guys that we're going to bring on in part two are also big fans of big line, power fishing it and doing it their way. We're going to get them on here in a second, but, thank you again to Mr. Brad Watley. We're definitely going to be getting him back on here several more times down the road here, for some different shows. And I think that just screams, we need to get him on the Lure Lab as well. I know Andy is in the comments as well still, but that was heck of a fun show. Make sure you guys follow Brad on his socials. We got that all linked down below. Make sure you guys tune in to stuff he's doing. Great two events in the Florida Swing, which is very hard to do, I feel like, consistently. Very seldom guys are able to do that. So cool to see him do it, and hopefully he can keep it rolling into Lake Murray. But the show is not over. We still have our part two here. We got Mr. Drew Gregory and Justin Largent here that are going to be joining us. But we'll be back with them here after a quick break and message from X2 Power.
In the world of battery power, a word to the wise. Compromise elsewhere.
Well, that was an awesome show. Hope you guys enjoyed it. If you can and your app allows it, please leave us a rating and review. It really helps us get seen more, which allows us to access more time and more variables to be able to bring to the show to make it better for you guys. So hope you enjoyed it. And if you did and you liked some of the things we talked about in this episode and want to check out our show partners, all of that is in every single show description. You can click down there. It's got all of our discount codes, all of our links to our show partners, where you guys can go and support the people that support this show and help us make this show happen. And of course, this show does not happen without you guys. You guys know we appreciate you. You're the Searsanger fam. You're the reason we're here. Appreciate y'all. And we'll see y'all on the next one.